access number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mell at Real 23. Now, we're talking about your staff navigators course at Central Navigation School, Cranage, in Cheshire.
Yes.
This was from roughly July to October, 1943.
Yes, right. That's right. Yes, it was 3 months, full 3 months, anyhow.
Anything else about the course you recall, any stories of what you were doing?
No particular stories at all. We spent a good part of the time in the lecture rooms. We did quite a lot of more advanced manoeuvres as far as navigation was concerned. There was a lot about astro. We also did tides. Oh, yes, we had exercises to do. Again, we were flying in ensigns again. It was a good all-work aircraft. And, yes, tides and water movement at coast, rivers and what have you, in case one got posted into Coastal Command or one of these far-off commands in Far East or Middle East. Lot about maps, the various projections and problems with all the various types of projections, because the whole problem, of course, was fitting a circular or a round area onto a flat chart. It just something had to be adjusted. Yes, we also did a certain amount of lecturing and all the items which one would expect to do if you were in a moderately senior position. Except a lot of it was the theory as well as the practical work, which previously we'd been largely been involved in just the practical side of it. But I thought it was a very satisfactory course.
And so next in October, your next posting is...
Said off on holiday, and I said to myself, please don't post me to Bishop's Court, which was Northern Ireland. So I thought, anywhere else but that. Anyhow, I eventually got a posting through and had to go to a place called Wigtown. I'd heard of Wigtown Shire, so I sort of vaguely knew where it was, looked it up on the map, and I thought, right, well, there's only one other place they could have sent me, which was West Frew, which was not out of the country. It was getting close to Bishop's Court, only just across the top of the Irish Sea. But anyhow, it was okay.
Number one observer.
Air Observer School, yeah.
Advanced flying unit.
Yeah, AFU, what have you. Again, we had... pupils and what have you, they're still training command posting, and having got myself and my wife up there, reported in, and I was allocated to a flying officer Wern, and we had a chat to start with. I found that he was an ex-103 squadron, the same as I was, except that he had served in France, as one of the first 10 squadrons which went to France in 1939. So he was a regular Air Force man. He'd been a flight sergeant and what have you previously to being commissioned. And there was another chap there, Peter Wright. I didn't have any connection with him at first, but eventually it came out that he had also been an evader as well. So that I had made contact and worked with two very desirable people, which we did, and we sort of had Len Wern was the course one of the course commanders, and we got on with flying and whatever we were supposed to do in lectures and general administration of the course.
This was Anson's again.
They were a jolly good workhorse, but eventually, I'm not sure how it came about, but we then became particularly interested in training on the ground to save flying time. In actual fact, there was always the planes were out sort of twice a day and sometimes three times, with two courses during the day and one at night, because there were several courses running parallel with each other, and time, flying time, was valuable. There was a building there which had been adapted for ground practice, but it seemed to be unused anyhow. I presume the chief instructor said, see what you can make of it, which we did. So we left the general course instruction, there was, yes, Lynn Moran and myself. I'm not sure whether Peter Wright came with us. I think we also gathered a flight sergeant up. And anyhow, three of us sort of moved into this building and decided to update it and develop it, which we did. In the meantime, then my warrant came through. I can't remember the date of that, but...
It says August 43.
August
43. It's given underhand 1st of September. So it's just before you went there, really.
Yeah, so this was while I was still at Cranage, the CNS. We were only part of the way through the course. Again, it sort of came through rather late. But it was backdated, of course.
Did it make a difference being a warrant officer?
Oh, yes. There was only about five on the camp at the time. Five, maybe six. And some of those, of course, were there was an armaments WO, there was a station WO, I think there was one in admin. There may have been, yes, one of the pilots. There weren't many, it was just a handful. It was definitely a advantageous rank to have. So,
anything else happening at Wigtown?
Not a great deal. We carried on developing this, making up new plans. We altered the building. We got a big route map up, and we introduced a sort of a general briefing to when a course came in for instruction, and. Previously, it rather looked as if they'd worked as pairs in little cubicles each, and one had done the actual navigation exercise, and somebody else had got all the information and just at appropriate times passed on the data that the exercise required him to do. So really, there was only one of them that got a decent exercise to carry on. So we changed that, and we then made the exercises up so that everyone in the course was faced with the same exercise and the same problems. And we introduced all sorts of things. We actually also had the clock adjusted by one of the instrument people on the camp, so that we could press the button and advance the clock, so that when there was a period which in normal time would perhaps run 15-20 minutes without you doing much other than just the basic checks, then we could cram a 5-hour, 6-hour flight into perhaps 3 hours. So they had to work a bit faster than normal. But it worked, and we also had another building erected in one of the hangars, which was quite complicated because it projected a view of the ground down onto a floor, which was sunk below the hangar level, and the building then was raised above it, and there was a series of levels. I think there were three levels we could occupy, perhaps something like 18, I think it was, pupils in a compartment where they looked through glass down onto the ground as if they were up 8,000 feet or 10,000 feet, whatever it was. And yeah, that was...
How realistic was it?
Oh, it was pretty. It was pretty good. Yes, it was pretty good. There had to be somebody in, up in the control room above where the projector was, because you had to project the scene down onto the ground, the plan view of the countryside down on the ground, and make alterations of course and what have you. And you could put you had the thing crawled along so that. It gave the effect of the ground passing underneath you all the time, and you could see when it made turns and the like. It was quite realistic, and it was certainly of use. During that time, then Flying Officer Wern said, "Well, there's other people there applying for commissions. Why don't you do so too?" So I bunged in the necessary papers, and. On his recommendation, saw the wing commander, the who commanded the educational or the training area, the group captain, and then myself and two other warrant officers who had turned up. One was Australian, one was New Zealand. We went to Dumfries and went up to see the AOC. The only amusing part about that was that we got a taxi from Dumfries out to group headquarters, and it turned out to be a Rolls Royce, so that when we turned up there in this Rolls Royce, then the guards on the gate sort of sprang to attention very quickly. I'm not sure they was happy when they saw three warrant officers get out. But that went through. Which I was very pleased about.
What was it like being an officer? For you, you've been a long-standing NCO. What was it like as an officer in the officers' mess?
Well, I did know most of the people, most of the officers one way or another, because as far as the training area, training officers were concerned, and the pilots, yes, they were quite welcoming, I think.
What did the officers' mess offer you? What was it like?
It was comfortable. It one that got used to a sort of better conditions than the airmen had, because you'd been in the NCO's mess, senior NCO's mess, and as a warrant officer, you had certain sort of privileges, so to speak, or people was sergeants had a certain deference towards a warrant officer. And it was then sort of reversed, because when you were PO, you were the lowest of the people in the mess.
As a pilot officer.
As a pilot officer, yeah. But I hoped I was going to get a bit of leave to go and get the uniform made down in London, but it didn't turn out like that. He said, "Well, we got so much on, because we were busy. Try barbers in Dumfries." So I was living out at the time, my wife was up there, so we had the odd day to go to Dumfries and back, which was about 65 miles, I suppose, by bus or train, whichever, and get fitted out. That was very satisfactory. I found life in the officer's mess, yes, very nice. The food was... excellent, in actual fact. Through some arrangement in the catering, we got to a point where we said, "Oh, well, not salmon again." And on its own, of course, it's a delicacy. But they got two lots or two contracts, so we had quite a bit of salmon, amongst other things. Food, yes, food was well cooked, and of course, the social life was yes, very interesting.
And there's one, just a thing that I only raised because of photographs. There's some sort of experimental pier heads from Mulberry Albert.
Oh, yes, that's right.
In Wigtown Bacon. What do you mean by that? It just looks like a normal pier to me.
In actual fact, it's in two parts. There is a big concrete sort of ends to the pier. That's not right. They were very much of an ordinary pier, and there was the floating gangway which would take traffic up and down so that ships could pull up by that actual gangway there and the head place here, and they'd be unloaded and the lorries would take whatever it was necessary back onto land. Those were being tried out against various sorts of weather and the like before they were made en masse for the use on Mulberry Harbour. There was also the big square concrete blocks, or rectangular concrete blocks, which were about as big as a block of flats, which were taken across the channel and then laid or sunk more or less end to end to break up rough weather, so that within their scope of this perimeter of concrete, big concrete flat-like things, then the water was fairly calm, and it made unloading troops and supplies much more easily. And it also, the flexible runways back to the shore were not rocked about quite so much. It was very much calmer.
And did you realise how secret they were, or did you know what they were at the time?
Not really. No, we didn't. No. We saw them from the air, we commented on them, but nobody seemed to know much about them. It wasn't until later that we realised fully the import of what was going on there. And it so happened I got hold of them, I got some pictures, and so I've included them.
Now, what happened next then? You were there till June 44, I think.
'44. Yes, that was D-Day period, wasn't it? Yes. Oh, well, there was a put down for a course, was I the only one? Yes, I was the only one that went from Wigtown. Came down south and went to North Luffnam in Rutlandshire. And they were running a course there for Flying Training Command instructors, largely on techniques of lecturing and other similar matters, and giving practice so that we got used to it, though we'd been doing it in the previous months.
Now, this is an FTCIS. Now, I don't know what that stands for at all.
FT, Flying Training. And what was the other letters?
CIS.
I don't know. Not now. C. Flying Training. Central Instructors School, or something like that, perhaps. It happened to be based on North Luffnam had been doing glider training and practicing towing techniques.
But that wasn't what you were there.
We know, just so coincidence, we were part of the way through the course, and then it came over the radio that. Yes, it did come over the radio, but more or less at the same time, then we saw a lot of Dakotas flying about. They'd all got white stripes on their wings, which was applied in the last few hours before they took off for the invasion of northern France. I think virtually all aircraft that went over that side there had white stripes on the wings, and also vertical ones on the fuselage. Certainly the gliders and what have you did. So that, to be quite honest, we weren't involved in it. But it was a very interesting period.
What did you think when you heard about D-Day? I mean, how did you feel? What did you think of the state of the war?
Well, I thought it was a great step forward. We'd sort of been involved since 1939, and here we were sort of getting on to 5 years later. It was time that things were moving forward for France, as well as it had been doing so for Italy, because and Northern Africa. The Northern Africa events had taken place in 42, the back end of 42, and there'd been a success there, and there was a varying success in Italy, in Sicily. So when the Second Front started, then I thought this was a great opportunity. We must have sufficient forces with the Americans and all the other units, Free French, the Norwegians, and what have you, to make a go of it.
Now, anything about the actual course as an instructor? Were you actually learning anything new?
Yes, I think they gave us more of an insight into the techniques of instruction. I was surprised to find that they considered that most individuals were only capable of absorbing information for about 40 minutes. So if you had an hour's lecture, which was the usual standard time, I suppose, then 40 minutes of that was useful. And beyond 40 minutes, then most people's attention was diverted. So we then sort of, in practice, we gave practice lectures to the rest of the course. We'd taken it in turn on a particular subject, whichever you picked up. Then we followed the general levels of information that we were getting from the course. Some of it was quite revealing as well. And we also develop ways of introducing the subject, not necessarily plunging straight in, but using analogies and what have you. It was interesting. Only lasted a fortnight.
So it's just in June.
Yes. It was quite short.
So it did improve your lecturing techniques.
I found it useful. Yes, and since then I sort of I suppose. Just automatically have followed the same process that we learnt there.
So what happens next? You're back to Wigtown?
So we went back to Wigtown there. And yes, we had an easy time of it. This is obvious. We were still carried on with the training. We sort of proceeded with the DR trainer. And Len Wern left Wigtown and was sent to the States on an official visit, which I was probably a flying officer by then. Anyhow, I was left in charge of the of that particular part of the training, and I had a number of sergeants and what have you working with me as well, so we had a staff coping with them. I don't know that there was anything particularly notable about it, except that when the war came to an end, which we are fast approaching, really.
So really, this is... Now, just one thing. How would you have felt if you'd been asked to go on another tour? Because that was perfectly possible.
Yes, it was possible. This happened at Wigtown. People had been there for some time. Suddenly got posted away. And some went back onto OMPS. There was quite a number of staff there who had probably been in training command most of their time in the RAF.
How did you feel about the prospect of?
I don't know. Not now. I thought it was always possible. If it had come, then one would have followed the... followed the instructions. Yes, the posting.
It wasn't something that particularly worried you.
No.
You didn't particularly want it, but if it had come, you'd have done it.
Oh yeah, oh, yes. There's no doubt about that. That's too long ago, really, this was a period of comparative calm, I would say. There was other problems which cropped up, but that was nothing to do with this particular issue. So
you were still in Wigtown until anything before V-Day. Was that the next big thing, really?
I think so. Yes.
Now, what do you remember of V-Day?
Oh, as I said, yes, we'd had several places in which I lived out in Wigtown. We had one at when we first went there at Forbank, which was a very nice double-fronted house in his own grounds, and they put us up. Charming people, very nice people. The man was retired, businessman from Manchester. We had some other places, and at the time of VE Day, then we had a flat in the centre of Wigtown. There was a yes, I suppose you would call it a square. It wasn't a true square architecturally, but it was a central square where there was some gardens and the main shops and what have you were sort of scattered around it. But it was though it was a county town, it was a very small place. You could walk through it in 10 minutes without any problem from the side to side. Anyhow, we had this flat onto the square, and I don't know when the announcement was made, but certainly we were in bed, and all of a sudden there was this gigantic racket outside of music and the like, and somebody had obviously heard about it on the radio, been up night work or something, and we looked out the window, and this was there was quite a crowd of people out there cheering and what have you. So that was the initial.
Did you join in the celebrations?
No. I mean, one was had to be back on duty first thing in the morning, and one had to get into the camp, so it meant leaving early. So we thought, took notice of it, and thought, right, we'll go back to bed.
Now, what next then? So you're still on at Wigtown.
We stayed on there, and. Yes, we sort of got about. We travelled about. We went up to Edinburgh. The only thing about Edinburgh we found was that we did go to a number of the odd restaurants when we were on holiday there for 7 days, I think it was. And there were the medical students and other students from the university in there as well. Coffee and the like, and felt very old compared with them. It's a very strange feeling, but quite often there was nobody else in uniform there, and it sort of set us aside and made me feel yes, they were quite youngsters, I suppose. Some of them were 20, 21 or thereabouts. I was only, 26 or so, and the gap seemed enormous. But there you are, you just put up with it. Yes.
Now, anything else happened while before the station closes down in October, I think it is?
Yes, it did.
Anything before that?
Not that I can mention it.
What happened about the station closing down? Was the whole thing closing?
Oh, yes, yes. The whole lot was closing down. Zero Wern, I didn't say his name was nicknamed, but it was, yes. Len Wern turned up again. He was now a squadron leader. And he said about, what are you going to do now they're closing down? I said, well, we shall get posted, obviously, so there's going to be nothing here. He said, well, do you want to... come to Chipping Warden. He says, I'm chief instructor there now.